letters correctly with their correct pronunciation. That's tajweed. Okay? Correct. Correctly. So, alayhim, not alayhim. Alayhim has another meaning. Alayhim, another meaning. So, two different meanings. So, you have to say alayhim. Okay? صراط الذين أنعمت عليهم. And also, I've seen a lot of people, okay, saying صراط الذين أنعمت عليهم. They are skipping that Hamza. While that's not Hamzatul Wasl. Hamzatul Wasl, you can skip it. But Hamzatul Qat'a, you don't have to skip it. You have to read it.
Yes.
Hamzatul Qat'a is that Hamza that has harakat. Look, it has harakat. Does it have or no?
Yes.
Fatha. It has.
So you have to read it. If there was like the head of Sod, the front part of Sod on the top, you would say Surat al-Ladhin an'amta alayhim. While the word an'ama, an'ama, this is a verb, okay? An'ama. An'ama yun'imu in'am. In Arabic we say Babul If'al. So yes, the Hamza of Babul If'al is Hamzatul Qat'a. You have to be very careful to not say Surat al-Ladhin an'amta alayhim. It's wrong. It's wrong. صراط الذين أنعمت عليهم. Okay. الحمد لله رب بالعالمين. Look that alif, that's Hamzatul Wasl. You see the shape of alif.
Yes.
That's Hamzatul Wasl. So you can skip it. Or if you stop, الحمد لله رب العالمين. You can read it. Al-alamin. But here, you don't have to skip that hamza in an'amta, okay? Thank you, Sayyid Musa. That was nice. But just pay attention to these points, okay? So, for what Haider is here to recite, let's listen to him. A'udhu billah.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Alhamdulillahi rabbil alameen. الرحمن الرحيم مالك يوم الدين إياك نعبد وإياك نستعين اهدنا الصراط المستقيم صراط الذين أنعمت عليهم غير المغضوب عليهم ولا الضالين.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much. There was a rule in level 2 we studied that when Alif Maddi approaches Hamzatul Wasl, the Mad will be skipped as well. So you directly join the Na sound to Sa. Ihdinas. You do not say Ihdinas Sirat. No. Ihdinas Sirat.
I didn't prolong it.
No, he said Ihdinas.
I know. But about Alif Maddi, I said this.
He replaced
Ghadid Ayn.
Instead of saying,
Look, Hamzatul Wasl. Hamzatul Wasl. It's not Hamzatul Wasl. Yes, Hamzatul Qat'.
Wa iyaka
nasta'in. Do not say wa iyaka, no. إِيَّاكَ نَعْبُدُ وَإِيَّاكَ نَسْتَعِينَ. Also, ya has tashdeed. So do not say إِيَّاكَ نَعْبُدُ وَإِيَّاكَ نَسْتَعِينَ. A lot of people say this.
I didn't say A.
Make it appear that E sound, okay? وَإِيَّاكَ. Look, it's very clear.
هَذَا الْقُرْآنُ يُوَحِّدُنَا لِطَرِيقِ الْخَيْرِ يُوَجِّهُنَا اللَّهُ تَعَالَى أَنْزَلَهُ وَرَسُولُ اللَّهِ مُعَلِّمُنَا وَرَسُولُ اللَّهِ مُعَلِّمُنَا هَذَا الْقُرْآنُ.
Want to learn Quran at home? Join us in our Quranic class. Let's recite the Quran.
الله تعالى أنزله ورسول الله معلمنا ورسول الله معلمنا.
Okay, thank you so much. Listen up. I will recite this surah, okay? You repeat after me. One ayah. All right?
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم.
So also pay attention. Do not say أعوذ. أعوذ no. A-U-Z. Two throat letters are there, yes? A-U. One is Hamza, one is Ayn. Both are like technical, yes? So challenging. So you might say A-U-Z. Some students say A-U-Z. They replace these two. A, it starts with A, then goes to Ayn. A-U-Z.
Yes.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم.
نير رجيم. Okay, نير رجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
الحمد لله رب العالمين.
الحمد لله رب العالمين.
الرحمن الرحيم.
الرحمن الرحيم.
مالك يوم الدين.
مالك يوم الدين.
If you have listened to عبد الباسط, one of the greatest reciters, he recites Maliki Yawmiddin, right? That's correct. Okay, Maliki. Maliki, Maliki, both are correct. Two types of recitations, both are correct. We have seven types of recitations, okay? Seven versions of recitations. So not in this word, okay? I mean totally, okay? We have seven reciters, okay? That we call them Qurra'u Sab'ah. Okay?
The seven reciters.
It means the seven, greatest. We say, yeah, reciters have narrators, yeah. The seven narrators of the recitation types, okay? Or styles, okay? So they all are acceptable, but we usually, okay, the ones which are very famous, the narration from Hafs, okay, from Asim, okay? And also, there is also another one from, it's Kufi, I think. It's from the Kufa, okay? So these two recitations are very, famous. So we usually recite with Hafs from Qasim, okay? This one. The way that the Prophet and Imam Ali alayhi salam, they were reciting with the Imams, okay? So, Maliki Yawmiddin. That's the way, okay? We recite. So, next surah, next ayah.
إياك نعبد وإياك نستعين. إياك نعبد وإياك نستعين.
إهدنا الصراط المستقيم.
إهدنا الصراط المستقيم.
طا طا طا. Put your tongue at the back of your front appetite. طا طا. Make no like How do you say, make your tongue go this way, okay?
Ta.
Ta, yes.
Ta.
Ta.
Ihdina الصراط المستقيم. Ihdina الصراط المستقيم.
صراط الذين أنعمت عليهم غير المغضوب عليهم ولا الضالين.
صراط الذين أنعمت عليهم غير المغضوب عليهم ولا الضالين.
أحسن. One more time. عليهم مغضوب. Okay, not عين. مغضوب.
صراط الذين أنعمت عليهم غير المغضوب عليهم ولا الضالين. صراط الذين أنعمت عليهم غير المغضوب عليهم ولا الضالين.
أحسن. غير.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين. الرحمن الرحيم. مالك يوم الدين. إياك نعبد وإياك نستعين. الصراط المستقيم صراط الذين أنعمت عليهم غير المغضوب عليهم ولا الضالين.
So, inshallah, let's take a break, okay? And we will be back. But before taking a break, let's give thanks to IRIB English Radio and also Sevier International Schools Network. We will be back, inshallah. Stay with us. وصلى الله على محمد وآله الطاهرين.
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجهم.
Let's recite the Quran. A joint production of IRIB English Radio and Sevier International Schools. ذكر وموعظة ونور فيه شفاء للصدور وشفيعنا يوم النشور آياته تروي المدى وصفاته نبع الهدى نلقى الجنان بحبه لن تستقيم حياتنا إلا به هو القرآن والفرقان إليه تنصت الأكوان وفيه تعطر الآذان والقرآن.
Anniversary of Sardasht chemical attack and day of combating chemical and biological weapons. Chemical weapons, which are classified as non-conventional weapons and their use prohibited by international law, were frequently used in the 1980s by the former Ba'athist regime of Iraq in its 8-year war against the Islamic Republic of Iran. These non-conventional weapons were used not only against military forces, but also against the civilian population of cities, towns and villages, particularly in western Iran. The Ba'athist regime of Iraq carried out a total of 582 chemical bombardments and chemical attacks on Iran between October of 1980 and August of 1988, which included limited chemical strikes, wide area strikes, and major chemical bombardments. These outlawed chemical attacks resulted in over 10,000 deaths, over 100,000 Iranians seriously injured and requiring continuous, often lifelong medical treatment, and a further 250,000 Iranians less seriously injured. In one notorious incident, the Halabja chemical bombardment in Iraqi Kurdistan resulted in the slaughter of over 5,000 Iraqi Kurds, with many more being injured. The first Ba'athist chemical attack on Iran, which was acknowledged and officially noted by the United Nations, occurred on 13th of January 1981 in an area 50 kilometers west of the city of Ilam in western Iran, where 10 Iranian military personnel were killed by exposure to chemical weapons. Professor Gerhard Freilinger, the head of the plastic surgery at University Hospital in University of Vienna, visited Iran in 1984 and did much to prove the use of chemical weapons by the Ba'athist regime of Iraq. Professor Freilinger embarked on his campaign after a group of Iranian victims of chemical weapons were brought to his hospital in Vienna for treatment. After seeing the burns and injuries inflicted upon a number of Iranian nationals, Professor Gerhard Freilinger was certain that chemical weapons had been used against these individuals. Saddam's army used chemical weapons in an extensive way from 1984 onwards until the end of the 8-year war in 1988. One such weapon, and a favorite of Saddam, was a chemical nerve agent, Tabun. Tabun was expensive and its raw materials were hard to obtain. This is why the Baathists switched to VX nerve gas later on. In 1988, at the end of the imposed war, the Baathists had about 4 tons of this deadly nerve agent, the VX nerve gas, at their disposal. Another nerve gas used extensively by the army of the former Iraqi dictator was sarin. They also use mustard gas, which causes chronic health problems for those who are exposed to it, including cancer, particularly lung cancer, sterility, and blindness. When the Achur imposed war started in September of 1980, Iran protested because of Iraq's use of chemical weapons. But the dictator Saddam initially denied using such weapons. However, after Iraq's extensive use of chemical weapons during the Ramadan and Khaybar operations, where the Iraqi Air Force and artillery fire used chemical bombs and chemical shells, not only against Iranian combatants, but also against the general civilian population of Iran, the world could see the reality of what was happening underground. Iraq's denials rang increasingly hollow. An international law expert, Sarson Modarres Sabzevari, says, "Chemical weapons have a special status among the myriad crimes and atrocities committed by the Baathist Iraqi army because of the destructive effect of these weapons, because of the damage it does to its victims, and the long-term chronic health repercussions of such weapons." A very prominent and notorious Iraqi chemical attack on the Islamic Republic of Iran occurred on 28th of June 1987. On that day, the Iranian border town of Sardasht, near the Iraqi border, was attacked with lethal chemical weapons. United Nations experts confirmed that the elderly, the civilian population, teenagers, children, toddlers and infants were all victims of this indiscriminate chemical attack. The Baathist Iraqi regime and its Western enablers committed horrific crimes in this small Western Iranian town. On 28th of June 1987, the Iraqi Air Force dropped 7 deadly chemical bombs on Sardasht. 2 bombs fell in the crowded central bazaar of this small town. 2 further bombs exploded in the residential districts of Sardasht, and 3 bombs fell in the orchards surrounding the town. The resulting carnage was horrific. Out of a total population of 12,000, 8,025 people were injured, many of them sustaining very serious and life-threatening injuries. 130 people were martyred on that fateful day. The Baathist regime had used mustard gas in this cruel and callous attack. Mustard gas is a chemical agent which persists in the environment. If it enters the human body, its debilitating effects can last a lifetime, and there is no known cure or effective medical treatment for mustard gas inhalation. Mustard gas is extremely harmful to a person's health and can cause serious lung infections, irreversible damage to the lungs, itching of your skin, shortness of breath and difficulty in breathing, and a burning sensation in your eyes. With the backing of the entire population of the town, and in particular the Society for Defense of Chemical Victims of Sardasht, the anniversary of the chemical attack on 28th of June each year was designated as the Day of Combating Chemical and Biological Weapons. This anniversary has been commemorated every year in the Islamic Republic of Iran since 2003. On 28th of June each year, in Sardasht itself and throughout the Islamic Republic. Hassan Sarki, The executive director of the International Affairs at the Martyrs Foundation of Iran says, "Even today, some 35 years after this horrific attack, there are thousands of victims of chemical weapons in Sardasht who suffer from the debilitating effects of these outlawed weapons, having received serious injuries to their lungs, their eyes, and their skin." Western countries, and in particular Germany, played a key role in supplying the Ba'athist regime of Saddam with the sophisticated equipment and raw materials and precursors necessary for manufacture of chemical weapons. For this reason, mainstream Western media and Western governments chose not to speak up and to deliberately ignore the unconventional chemical attacks of the Ba'athist regime against the Islamic Republic of Iran. Western media deliberately turned a blind eye to these attacks in the 1980s. Literally, dozens of Western chemical companies supported Iraq in its clandestine effort to manufacture outlawed chemical weapons. And this effort was led by Germany. Irrefutable evidence points to the active involvement of 85 German firms, 19 French firms, 18 Italian companies, and 18 American firms in the Ba'athist effort to manufacture deadly chemical agents. European media, and in particular German media, have broadcasted and published extensively with regards to these firms, and according to German media, Imhausen Chemie, and according to German media, Imhausen Chemie, a German firm based in the town of Lahr, an old Rhine Valley town on the fringes of the Black Forest in Germany, played a key role in enabling Iraq to manufacture chemical weapons. A number of Western countries provided Iraq with engineering and technical know-how, equipment, chemical warhead technology for missiles, etc., and played an instrumental role in manufacture of Saddam's deadly arsenal of chemical weapons. Iraq, in an official report in 1991, admitted to receiving 17,602 tons of chemicals, equipment, and other technology for its chemical weapons program. Esmail Baghaei Hamaneh, a senior Iranian diplomat and ambassador, points to the German government as a key enabler of the Ba'athist Iraqi regime in its quest for chemical weapons. Esmail Baghaei Hamaneh says, "The German government bears a great responsibility in this regard. Any individual or company which helped the Ba'athist regime to acquire chemical weapons is a partner in the crimes and atrocities committed by the former Iraqi dictator Saddam and his regime." Given the Ba'athist regime's extensive use of chemical weapons throughout the 8-year imposed war, Iran submitted numerous reports to the United Nations, informing the UN about the use of these outlawed weapons. The Secretary General of the United Nations at the time, Javier Perez de Cuellar, with his team of accompanying experts, visited Iran for 6 days and confirmed the use of chemical weapons by the Iraqi side. The United Nations duly condemned Iraq for its use of outlawed and prohibited weaponry. Interestingly, though, Javier Perez de Cuellar's report doesn't actually mention Iraq, although it condemns Saddam's use of these weapons. The Islamic Republic of Iran, meanwhile, tried to draw the attention of the international community to the scale and the depth of the horrific events in Sardasht, by sending the victims of chemical bombardment to hospitals and medical centers throughout the world. Finally, on 26th of March 1986, the United Nations Security Council issued a belated condemnation of the all-too-obvious war crimes of the former Iraqi dictator Saddam and his use of outlawed chemical agents in the war against Iran. One good thing to emerge out of this tragedy in the 1980s was that in the following decade, the 1990s, sufficient impetus and momentum was built up for a treaty to be signed by the international community to prohibit the use of all types of chemical weapons. The Convention on the Prohibition of Development, Production, Stockpiling, and Use of Chemical Weapons and on their destruction, the Chemical Weapons Convention, or the CWC, is comprised of a preamble, 24 articles, and 3 annexes. The Annex on Chemicals, the Verification Annex, and the Confidentiality Annex. The Chemical Weapons Convention, the CWC, aims to eliminate an entire category of weapons of mass destruction by prohibiting the development, production, acquisition, stockpiling, retention, transfer, or use of chemical weapons by state parties. State parties, in turn, must take the steps necessary to enforce that prohibition in respect to persons, both natural or legal, within their jurisdiction. The Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, the OPCW, an intergovernmental organization based in The Hague, the Netherlands, was set up to administer the Chemical Weapons Convention, the CWC. The treaty entered into force on 29th of April 1997 and prohibits the large-scale use, development, production, stockpiling, and transfer of chemical weapons and their precursors. As of March 2021, 193 countries have become parties to the CWC, the Chemical Weapons Convention, and accept its obligations. Also, 29th of April was designated as the Day of Remembrance for all victims of chemical warfare. The Iranian Parliament, the Majlis, ratified the Chemical Weapons Convention, the CWC, and Iran officially acceded to the treaty in 1997, one of the first countries to do so. Every December, the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, the OPCW, holds a gathering in honor of the victims of chemical weapons, and a delegation of victims from Sardasht in northwestern Iran represents the Islamic Republic of Iran at this gathering each year.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Strikes in Europe's transport sector have disrupted air flights and train schedules as transportation companies struggle to cope with rising demand at the start of the peak of summer travel season after COVID restrictions were lifted. A strike by staff members at Irish Airline, Ryanair, and Brussels Airlines over pay and working conditions forced the cancellation of many flights. The workers' strike also disrupted flight schedules in Spain, Italy, France, Portugal, and Belgium. Meanwhile, earlier this week, the British railway system once again came to a halt. tens of thousands of workers have walked in Britain's biggest rail strike in 30 years, with millions of passengers facing days of chaos as both the unions and the government have stuck to their guns in a row over pay. The British Transport Union, the National Union of Rail, Maritime and Transport Workers, RMT, threatened to continue the industrial action until managers address the workers' grievances and meet their salary demands. According to the UK Government Career Service, RMT members who are not high earners, for example train guards and track maintenance staff, earn somewhere between £20,000 to £35,000. But the union says its members deserve more. Despite the ongoing negotiations between representatives from the management and staff, the media predicted the strikes to continue. They attributed further industrial action to the rapidly rising inflation rates exacerbated by sluggish economic growth, saying this combo will likely lead to more worker strikes across the European continent in the summer ahead.
The people who are on strike have been pretty clear about it, including in Great Britain with the railroads, the airline pilots, and everybody else. For some years, they've been in trouble and there have been increasing social unrest. And what's happening now is a huge increase in inflation and hence a decrease in purchasing power, and people's standard of living is going down. And so you're having a confluence of events. You have this economic crisis, then you have this people saying, listen, we cannot let the war in Ukraine completely derail the environmental crisis. And furthermore, the policies, as another group saying, look, the policies that we're pursuing, that our governments are pursuing in Ukraine, are adding to the problem, not making it better.
Unions have said the rail strikes could mark the start of a summer of discontent, with teachers, medics, and even waste disposal workers heading for industrial action as inflation pushes 10%. Inflation has soared across Europe on the back of a major rise in energy costs, and Britain is not alone in facing strikes. Russia's war in Ukraine pushed the already rising inflation in countries that use the euro to a record high in May, with energy projected to have the steepest annual rate. As the war in Ukraine drags on through its fourth month, the West, led by US and NATO, remains largely united in backing Kiev, but they are divided over how long they're willing to endure the conflict's economic fallout. The prospect of a drawn-out conflict with the battle raging in eastern Ukraine has raised questions about whether war fatigue, coupled with skyrocketing food prices and energy bills, could test countries' political will to keep pressuring Moscow over time. In the U.S., President Joe Biden blamed the Russians for rising U.S. gas prices, saying it was outrageous what the war in Ukraine is causing. Hungary, on the other hand, has called for immediate peace talks to end the war between Ukraine and Russia, warning that a prolonged conflict will fuel an economic crisis that will imperil governments across Europe. Meanwhile, the United Nations has warned of an unprecedented global hunger crisis in light of the recent developments.
There's a couple of different things going on here. There is the United States as an outlier in NATO in a certain sense, with some of the Eastern European companies really pushing for more and more aggressive behavior by NATO in Ukraine. You have other countries which are in Western Europe who are suffering from the United States activities here, the real pressure. Economically, and are beginning to say, wait a minute, this is not what we really want to have here. Our population's getting upset. And then you have apparently the failure of the sanctions. And in the United States press, at least, the understanding that maybe they're not going to work so well. And so the Russians are not going to be suffering so much.
Western countries rallied around Kiev when Russia began its military operation in Ukraine in February. But now that unity is being tested as soaring inflation and energy shortages rebound on their own citizens. Now, the UN Human Rights Office agrees that the veteran Palestinian journalist was killed by Israeli fire last month. The probe finds that Abu Akleh and her colleague were targeted by seemingly well-aimed bullets as they covered a military raid in the occupied West Bank.
all the information we have gathered, including official documentation from the Israeli military and the Palestinian Attorney General, is consistent with the finding that the shots that killed Abu Akleh and injured her colleague came from Israeli security forces and not from indiscriminate firing by armed Palestinians, as was initially claimed by the Israeli authorities.
So far, several media organizations have conducted their own investigations into the incident, and all have come to the same conclusion. Multiple witnesses also agreed with the probe, stating that Israeli forces shot the veteran Palestinian reporter. Meanwhile, Al Jazeera and its host country Qatar pointed the fingers at Israel from the outset. The UN has also confirmed that Abu Akleh was wearing a blue flak jacket marked with the word press when being shot by Israeli troops, exposing the gruesome nature of the daylight murder and suggesting that they were deliberately targeted.
As long as the United States and its allies continue to not only embrace this position, but to promote this position using every tactic at their disposal, including threats, the more that has been the case, the more the occupation is quite happy to resort to war crimes bordering on what one could also say are crimes against humanity, albeit in a very calculated move, drawn out over a period of decades, as is the case with ethnic cleansing, which if it happened over a shorter period of time, would fit very nicely with the definition of a genocide.
The killing of yet another journalist is, however, in line with the pattern of Israeli violence against reporters and other members of the media. The Palestinian Ministry of Information says at least 45 journalists have been killed by Israeli forces since 2000. Israeli brutality against Palestinians and journalists has been a topic of discussion for many years now. The regime has, however, never accepted blame for its wrongdoing, and in nearly all cases baselessly shifted the blame on Palestinians, and the case of Abu Akleh is no exception. Following the UN's report, the Israeli regime insisted that the fatal shooting of Abu Akleh was unintentional, pointing out at the same time that it had not received access to critical evidence that might determine whether she was killed by an Israeli soldier or a Palestinian gunman. Israel's military also says Palestinian authorities should hand over the bullet that killed Shireen. The demand has, however, been met by widespread criticism, with Palestinians saying the regime should hand over the gun, which is believed to have killed the journalist, as Israel can't be trusted of conducting a fair investigation of itself. The murder of Abu Akleh, which sparked global outrage, only adds to Israel's long list of atrocities against Palestinians. But that fury has yet to translate into any concrete measure, particularly by international bodies such as the UN Security Council. So far, several international organizations have provided evidence of Israel's brutality against Palestinians. UN resolutions have also been passed against Israel for its occupation and blockades of the coastal enclave. Yet, no one, including the UNSC, has used any of its tools to ensure resolutions related to ending the Israeli siege imposed on Gaza have been implemented.
The complete lack of accountability only encourages, as we have seen, more war crimes by the occupation. And the unfortunate that the position long taken by the number one sponsor of the occupation, the United States of America, is that Palestinians and Israelis should resolve their differences through negotiation, and in both instances should be prevented from invoking international law and the institutions which administer it in order to impose a solution in keeping with their respective legal obligations in the so-called rules-based international order. And that, of course, is really quite absurd.
Instead, many of the UNSC member states have doubled their support for Israel, despite its blockade and bombardment of Gaza and murdering dozens of innocent women and children. Some even increased their support for the regime and obliged neighboring countries to forge ties with it. And in absence of action, there is no reason to expect Israeli violence against the Palestinians, whether a journalist or not, whether well-known or not, will end anytime soon. Thank you.
Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says the European Union and NATO are gathering a coalition for war with Moscow. This after the EU unanimously granted candidacy status to Ukraine and Moldova. Lavrov drew parallels between current-day events and those of the first half of the 20th century when Germany was preparing an attack on the Soviet Union.
When the Second World War was about to start, Hitler gathered most of the European countries under his banners. Now the EU and NATO are also gathering the same modern coalition for the fight, and by and large for war with the Russian Federation. We will look at this very carefully.
Lavrov's remarks came after the EU leaders stepped up rhetoric against Russia.
EU's decision strengthens Ukraine and Moldova in the face of Russian aggression.
A confrontation between Moscow and NATO's nuclear-armed members would have catastrophic consequences for Europe. After all, Europe would be the immediate theater of such a war.
In terms of the possibilities of war, NATO fighting a war with Russia, I don't think they are very good. First of all, because the United States will not suffer as a result of this war. The Europeans will suffer. The Europeans, if they start down this path, they will unleash a nuclear war, in which case their entire, all of the NATO countries will be destroyed, all of the NATO bases. It will be a catastrophe for these people. And I think the leaders of the three major countries, Germany, France, and Italy, I think they understand this. And I think that's why they have been going to Kiev to have discussions with President Zelensky. They know that the people, this is not in their interest.
Candidate status is only the first step on the path to EU membership, which can take decades. But putting the EU action in the context of the current state of affairs, we can see that the rising escalation might quickly lead to catastrophic consequences. Tensions are also increasing between the EU and Russia over the growing Kaliningrad crisis. This after Lithuania began enforcing the EU sanctions and restricted the transit of goods to Kaliningrad. Moscow says the move amounts to a blockade of its exclave and has warned of serious consequences.
As for retaliatory measures and what they will be like, will they be exclusively in the diplomatic dimension? The answer is no. They will not be in the diplomatic dimension. They will be practical.
A move by Russia on Lithuania would clearly trigger NATO's Article 5 mutual defense provision, immediately pulling in all the alliance's members to a potential nuclear war with Russia. But how far can the Europeans really push for such an escalatory path with Russia, especially at a time when they are experiencing an energy crisis?
If you're asking me personally, I personally think that the main reason for the war in the Ukraine was to block the alliance between Germany and Russia. And the symbol of that alliance was the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which never got opened. As a result, now Germany is in a critical crisis because Russia has control of its energy. Russia just dialed down 40% of its energy. Germany cannot survive under these conditions. It is not in Germany's interest to commit suicide for the United States of America.
On Thursday, Ukraine said it had received U.S. supplies of high-mobility artillery rocket systems, a powerful long-range weapon system that Kiev hopes can help turn the tide on Russia's military offensive. Russian officials have repeatedly warned that the U.S. decision to supply Ukraine with advanced rocket systems could exacerbate the conflict.
Iran has released fresh details about the covert and planned operations of agents of Israeli spy agency in Iran. Officials say the three agents detained back in April were planning to assassinate Iranian nuclear scientists. Officials say the agents were arrested following a complicated intelligence operation that lasted 8 months. Judiciary officials say some members of the cell have been arrested in Iran's southeastern Sistan and Balochistan province, while other members and operatives have been detained outside the province by Iran's intelligence forces. Officials say the case is under preliminary investigation and that an indictment would be filed and sent to court soon. This is not the first time Iran busts Mossad-linked terrorists. In July last year, Iran's intelligence ministry arrested a network of agents with the Israeli Mossad spy agency at the western borders, confiscating a large cache of weapons and ammunition that they were planning to use to provoke riots and terror inside the country.
Well, of course there should be, and I don't think anyone is really going to seriously say it's unthinkable that Israel would try to assassinate Iranian figures, whether in science or politics. They've got a demonstrable propensity to do so, and they boast about it.
The arrests come amid open threats by Israeli officials against Iranian nuclear scientists and facilities. The regime is notorious for its sabotage activities and assassinations in Iran.
And the reason behind its stepped-up hostility toward Iran, and a very open hostility, is that Israel seeks to be the lone superpower, or you could say mini-superpower of the region, as a junior partner of the big superpower, the United States.
Israel has tried various ways to stop Iran's nuclear progress. They include acts of sabotage, assassinating Iranian nuclear scientists, as well as threats to bomb Iran's nuclear installations. Probably the most high-profile assassination was the killing of Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, a top Iranian nuclear scientist who was brutally murdered by Mossad agents in 2020. Mossad was involved in an explosion that hit Iran's Natanz nuclear facility in 2021. Israel was also the main regional force that pushed the United States to exert economic and diplomatic pressure on Iran. The policy culminated in the so-called maximum pressure campaign of former President Donald Trump. But none of those policies reached their stated goals. Iran's economy did not collapse, and its nuclear program has accelerated massively after the U.S. quit the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA, in 2018.
It's the whole establishment, the whole Israeli establishment, that has this extreme hostility toward Iran and wants to continue to take action in the hopes of provoking something greater. It carries out assassinations, there's no question about that. It carries out bombings inside the country, carried out by covert agents. I think right now the United States government is not wishing to see an escalation into a full-blown war. And Israel does, in the final analysis, have to pay attention to what Washington thinks and says.
Just recently, a top U.S. think tank admitted to Israel's failure towards Iran. A report by Atlantic Council said that Israel's policy has failed to stop Iran. The article said the Tel Aviv regime needs to recalculate and adopt a strategy that corresponds to the current state of the Iranian nuclear program. Given the current state of affairs, the United States, which is Israel's staunch ally, needs to reconsider its unilateral support for Israel.
Cultural news, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With the light.
With soaring fuel prices, the importance of solar-powered vehicles is on the rise. Now a Kashmiri math teacher has gone viral for creating a car powered by solar energy. The car, which is fully covered with solar panels, uses sunlight to charge its battery. The vehicle also has a braking system that regenerates power to its batteries. The inventor of the car, Bilal Ahmed, says he has spent about $19,000 for his project and has not used external funds.
It was my dream to invent a solar car for the people of Kashmir. It took me 13 years to complete my dream. I'm thankful to the Almighty I succeeded in this project.
Bilal says he has built the car manually and without any automation. He hopes to put his fully automatic car into mass production to create jobs for local people.
Just like humans and animals, plants get sick too. But what do you do with an ill plant? An Indian man has found an answer to that. He has opened an emergency room only for plants in Amritsar, a city in India's Punjab state. A tax officer and his wife have set up the Pushpa Tree and Plant Hospital. In Pushpa, they have expert biologists and tree lovers on hand to provide the so-called sick patients with their essential nutrients. The clinic aims to treat any and every disease and even has an emergency vehicle on call for unhealthy trees around the city. The officer's wife says, just as we humans bleed, breathe, and need cures, plants also bleed, breathe, and need cures.
We provide approximately 32 various services for plants and trees, like if there's a nail in the tree, how to take out that nail, deep poisoning of the trees. Yes, you heard it right. There are people who poison the trees. Again, if the tree is not bearing fruits, there's an attack of mealybugs or another insects. That's also cured here. If the trees or plants are dying and you're unable to take care of them, even that problem is sorted out.
Only a month into the hospital's operation, Rohit Mehra and his team of 20 volunteers have already received more than 300 queries. The hospital is also completely free of charge. Staff at the National Zoo of Cuba in the capital city of Havana are celebrating a new arrival of a rare baby white rhinoceros. The little calf, named Al, quickly became popular among other animals in the park after he was born. He is part of a conservation program that will add to a gene bank for future breeding. Al is the second white rhinoceros to be born in captivity in 18 years. The park is home to 8 white rhinos and 4 black ones. Zoo staff say the park has one of the largest exhibits of this mammal among zoos in Latin America. White rhinos are endangered species and their population has dwindled due to illegal poaching and environmental destruction.
Persian fallow deer is a unique but endangered species known for its sleek and spotted body. In this report, our correspondent Youssef Jalali takes us on a quick tour around one of the world's few protected shelters of Persian fallow deer in Iran's city of Sari.
We had to keep quiet and avoid making any sounds to film them, as they are shy and swift, and the slightest sound could send them sprinting and jumping away. Over 60 Persian fallow deer roam in Dashtanaz Wildlife Refuge in Iran's northern city of Sari. The endangered species is carefully protected here to be safe from predators and poachers.
The Persian fallow deer is native to Iran's Khuzestan province, but due to loss of habitat and threats posed to them by predators such as jackals and wild cats, they are endangered and need to be protected in semi-natural refuges like this one.
Persian fallow deer are mainly indigenous to open woodland areas spanning from East Mediterranean coasts to West and Southwest Iran. By 1875, they had gone extinct in all of their main habitats, except in southwest Iran. After a captive breeding program, the population has rebounded from only a handful of deer in the 1960s to over 200 individuals in Iran.
Dashtinoz
Wildlife Refuge is a 55 hectares wide. It was introduced in 1962 as a shelter for the Persian fallow deer when the species was on the brink of extinction. At that time, 5 deer were captured and translocated to this refuge. Over the past 6 decades, their number have been multiplied through captive breeding.
The Persian fallow deer is a rare ruminant mammal belonging to the family Cervidae. They're physically larger than other fallow deer, and their antlers are bigger and less palmate. Their special beauty has turned this sanctuary into a hot tourist attraction in Iran's north.
This sanctuary is a tourist destination for visitors who would like to see the Hyrkanian forests in Iran's north and at the same time enjoy the wildlife and learn about efforts made to save the Persian fallow deer from extinction.
In 2015, the Persian fallow deer was registered in the IUCN Red List of Threatened Species. Dashtinoz authorities hope through continued captive breeding, the population of these special creatures will soon reach the desired number, and hopefully they will be reintroduced to their natural habitat in southwest Iran.
While they live far from their original habitat, these alluring creatures feel at home here, where they will be safe from the dangers lurking outside, which may lead to their extinction. So here, Persian fallow deer continue to embellish the nature and charm visitors with their beauty. Yusuf Jalali from Dashtinoz Wildlife Refuge in Sari.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Catching fish makes you forget even the most complex problems. But think the moment you catch the strangest one. Well, a Cambodian fisherman has caught what researchers say is the world's biggest freshwater fish ever recorded. The giant fish, which weighs around 300 kilograms and 4 meters long, was caught last week from the Mekong River. The female stingray was released back into water after being electronically tagged to allow scientists to monitor her movement and behavior. The fish was named Barami, meaning full moon in the Khmer language. An American fish biologist, Dana Lee, says the data collected from Barami can help protect the species and its habitat.
We got a call this morning at breakfast that they had caught a giant stingray here at Coprea. So we dropped everything. People came up from Phnom Penh, and we're here now just at sunset. Just tagged the giant, 330-kilogram giant stingray here in the Mekong River, and released it here right at sunset.
The stingray dethrones the former record holder, a 290-kilogram catfish found in northern Thailand in 2005. More than 1,000 species live in the Mekong River. The famous waterway originates in China and twists south through parts of Thailand, Laos, Myanmar, Cambodia, and Vietnam. Scientists have warned that plastic waste and dam threaten wildlife even in the deepest stretches of the Mekong. Geologists are rejoicing over a new discovery. A 290-million-old fossil forest has accidentally been found in southern Brazil. A team of geologists had been sent to the state of Paraná to investigate the rocks there. To their surprise, they were able to find over 160 logs of lycophytes, an extinct variety of the vascular plant subgroup. It's quite rare occurrence that a large number of fossils of the plant were found preserved in upright position for such a long time. The forest itself was discovered in 2018 when a street was being constructed over there. So far.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.